There are many joys in parenting and otherwise helping guide young people. Plenty of frustrations, too, like when you try to make meaningful contact with a kid and get almost nothing in return. We'll focus on that process with boys in this hour. Lots of books have been written in recent years about the challenges of reaching boys. Our guest this hour has written another with some concrete suggestions on how to reach a young male. Adam Cox is a therapist and the author of Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. Adam is a clinical psychologist practicing in Rhode Island, so he does talk to many young people. And he travels plenty to speak about what he's learned over the years. Adam's previous books include Boys of Few Words and No Mind Left Behind. Adam Cox, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Girls have their own issues too, I'm sure, but what led you to focus on boys?
Well, two things. One is the strong desire to help parents and to help schools make contact with kids, because this is a chronic source of frustration. I spent most of my 25 years in clinical practice focusing on this issue, and so I'm aware of how important it is for families and schools to do this. But secondly, and this is so important, is I wrote the book to advocate for boys, because I feel like for so many years we have essentially had a very reductive perspective of boys, basically thinking of them only in terms of their behavior problems and not digging very deeply into their psychology.
So, Adam, is there a boy crisis, as some people put it, and either way, does it mean that boys have changed over time?
I think there is a boy crisis, although I think it might be somewhat different than what we think it is. For example, you know, when we think of the boy crisis, we think of the big issues like gaming. We think of, you know, their involvement in bullying in some ways, their access to pornography, their disinterest in school. These are all the big kind of headline issues that we think about when we talk about boys. And unfortunately, because we are so preoccupied with those headline issues, we forget to investigate the things that are of high relevance to boys, which is really the struggle to find any sense of authenticity and any sense of purpose in the world. These are the big crisis issues with respect to boys, as far as boys are concerned.
And are these issues about entering puberty, or do they happen even earlier than that?
I think that some of them do manifest earlier than that, but they don't become a crisis till puberty. It's at puberty where we see kids get incredibly moody and more withdrawn. We see them feel more confident in acting autonomously. They have more opinions. They're more willing to draw certain boundaries in life. And so they become more difficult to work with. But this whole issue with needing to be purposeful and to have some kind of meaningful role within the context of your family and school, that's around much earlier.
Right from the get-go, I can imagine people hearing this and thinking, well, I want to talk to the boys. They won't answer.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And unfortunately, when we try to talk to boys, sometimes we put the cart before the horse and we focus on questions that we want to know, which often come across as a kind of interrogation, and we forget to set the table with respect to the tone of conversation. And all great communication is much more about the form than it is about the content. And so the first half of my book is focused on how to set the table for a great tone of conversation, and the second half is focused on the big themes that are of high relevance to boys.
So it seems like in your own experience, getting boys in groups is what helped you learn.
Yeah, that's true, in that, you know, years ago, schools would call me and they would ask if some of their students, several of their more difficult students, could be included in a social skills group. And so I'd been working a lot with boys individually, and I decided to run these groups and try to, you know, give kids an opportunity to interact with one another. And I had no idea how difficult it was going to be to get boys to engage. And when I would go out to the waiting room to kind of bring them back to my office, they'd be there with their arms folded, staring at the floor, no interest in engaging. And I got so frustrated with trying to get through to kids, I almost gave up in working with them. And I tell the story in my book. It wasn't until I was home one weekend and accidentally saw the movie Gladiator for the first time, and I saw Russell Crowe in the role of Maximus in the opening scene, needing to galvanize his troops to go into battle, and he uses this creed, strength and honor, and he kind of greets the soldiers with this kind of creed of strength and honor. And I sort of realized as I was watching that that's what my guys needed too, is that they were feeling like they were the identified problem in having to come to my group. They were feeling like there was, you know, something deficient about them. And so I used this more kind of warrior creed, and I began to, you know, greet them in a slightly different way, and suddenly I found that they became engaged in the group. And I think that the take-home message from that, Jeff, and what I hope people listening realize, is that when we help boys to feel about themselves the way that they want to feel, which is more confident about themselves, then they much more readily engage with us.
So having been sent off to some group where they have to get some sort of quote-unquote corrective action immediately puts them at a bit of a disadvantage, it sounds like.
That's exactly right. They felt like I am the identified problem or what's wrong with me. And that's exactly, you know, in over 20 years doing therapy with boys, what every boy is thinking when he sits down on the therapist's sofa is, what have I done wrong now? Because that's the assumption, is that I'm in therapy because I've done something wrong, and I'm being forced into therapy to be accountable for a mistake that I've made. And that is such a difficult hurdle to get past, but it is something that we need to kind of get past, because it's only when conversation starts that is not around a corrective problem that boys really open up and they really allow themselves to engage the benefits of therapy.
So how did you use the gladiator example? You didn't say, let's go attack the Huns. So what cause did you unite them to solve?
Great. So a couple of things. I first began to greet them with kind of an extended fist, not a fist pump, but I would push slightly against their fist. They would push back, and I would say strength and honor, and I would teach them to say that back to me. Then as we went back to my office, what I would do is I had this shark tooth amulet that I had found in Australia, and I brought it back, and I would pass it around and give it to the boy who demonstrated the most social courage, which was often being more open, more communicative with other members of the group. And I saw that they were really engaging. And then we began to do things like, you know, I would come up with a chant, and we would all kind of do this chant together. And eventually I began to engage them in projects like, you know, raising money for a nearby animal shelter, mm-hmm. and we constructed a book. We wrote a book.
Okay.
About different types of animals and sold it to raise money. So
you really made a team out of them. We'll have to come back and pick the story up on the other side of a break. Adam Cox, our guest. His book is Cracking the Boy Code. Back in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Adam Cox, a clinical psychologist, a practicing therapist in Rhode Island, works with lots of young people for many years now, and has written several books about what he's learned, including one that can help a lot of us in trying to deal with young males. The book is called Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about the process of talking to boys, partly through form and partly through content. That's how the book is divided up. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, in applying the gladiator example, it sounds like you really made this about more than just there's something wrong with me individually. It became like we have a common purpose here as a group.
That's exactly right. Reinforcing our common strength, our unified strength, and the fact that we can be, you know, effective and competent in different ways, and of course that builds confidence in individual kids and they become more willing to share and connect.
So for the rest of us then, who are not going into therapy sessions knowing as much as you do, I mean, one of the things that we seem to notice first is that boys after a certain age do seem to talk less to adults than they do to each other. You say don't fight that?
I think that that's true, is that, you know, we want to connect with kids, and I think we have a chance to do that, but we shouldn't feel as though something is wrong if they have a greater interest in connecting with their peers, because this is just a developmentally appropriate thing that happens to kids, is that they become much more interested in these interactions with their peers. I think that doesn't mean that we say, well, okay, we're not going to have a connection, but we have to have different strategies than what we would use with younger boys. And one of the key things is, one of the most important things to remember is, when we minimize vulnerability, we greatly increase the odds that kids will talk to us. And one of the ways that we do that is we take some of the emotion out of our voices. We use in my book what I call more of a task tone. We're more kind of directive, more matter of fact, and we make less eye contact. One of the most problematic things that families will sometimes do is try to have a deep, you know, heart-to-heart conversation with a young man across the kitchen table. And that is the worst place to have that conversation, because boys do not like it. They get uncomfortable when you're looking deep into their eyes, asking them questions, often which they don't have answers for. You know, we sometimes think that kids are withholding, but in the case of so many boys, it's that they don't actually know how to answer the questions that they're being asked. And so they might, if they have a chance to reflect on it or to think about it, and a much better place to get them thinking and to give them a more fair chance of responding is if you have that conversation driving in the car with them. You're looking out the windshield. You're avoiding the eye contact. There's something about the motion of the car that often makes it easier for kids to connect. So doing something like that or playing a game. In my office, I am constantly, kids will come in and they'll not want to have any conversation with me. And so I just reach for some type of a ball and I begin tossing it. And, of course, naturally you're looking at the ball. You're not making the eye contact. And it just makes it easier for kids to talk.
So it has to be less confrontational physically. I mean, not face-to-face, not eye-to-eye. Does this mean you have to put up with stuff like you can stop saying things like, please look at me when I'm talking to you?
Exactly, because when we do that, it is totally appropriate for kids to make eye contact in some aspects of life. In the social skills groups that I've run, I've always taught kids we listen with our eyes as well as our ears. But at moments of vulnerability, when we're asking them questions that are more ambiguous or that involve some degree of emotion, making that eye contact makes it harder for them to think and harder for them to kind of, you know, reach for answers for whatever we're asking. So, yeah. Doing something together is a natural way to avoid the eye contact.
So, and then this too about keeping the task tone and not letting emotion creep into your voice. If the child is being immature and acting bratty, you still have to be the adult.
Absolutely. You know, there's no problem in being authoritative. It's being authoritarian that sometimes gets us into trouble, because if it's a my way or the highway approach, kids will often shut down. That works with younger kids, but by the time kids reach 13 or 14, that really backfires. So, but we can always be authoritative, and I think that kids respect that. I think that they respect it. There is a degree in this task tone that I'm recommending. There is a kind of sense of seriousness and respect when we use that kind of tone. And I want to reinforce that I'm not talking about talking like a drill sergeant. This is not being kind of, you know, in a command personality or something like that. But it's just being more serious, more directive, more matter-of-fact, watching the kind of tone of your voice so there isn't a sense of too much heightened emotion.
All right, but how to know when to cut your losses and try this again a different time if, for example, you're doing all your best efforts and you're getting nothing back but grunts?
Right. So, you know, sometimes when that happens, the thing to do is to say that, well, words are not, we're not ready for words yet. We have to just begin doing something. And it's kind of like the scenario that I use in my office. Kids will often refuse to talk to me, and that's why I say, let's just kind of do something. I'm going to tell you like a little secret. I mean, this sounds like a very unusual thing for a therapist, but my practice is in like kind of a coastal fishing village in Rhode Island, and out in the gravel parking lot of my office, I keep my pickup truck, and sometimes I have some heavy bags of gravel in the back, and for kids that really are struggling, I'll ask them to come out and move those bags with me to do something physically taxing before we even begin to talk about anything.
Wow, that's amazing. We're talking to Adam Cox about his book, Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. By phone, email address is jx@jeffnet.org. The idea of entering the mental orbit that you write about, how do we get in there?
Well, the mental orbit of boys is unfortunately occupied to a large extent these days by the things that really amuse them. And one of the challenges that we have in connecting with boys here in the early 21st century is that they are part of a spectator culture, and that spectator culture is directed at all forms of trivial amusement, which is, you know, the term that I would use for games, is that, you know, the games are a lot of fun, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to try to, you know, argue about, you know, whether the games are fun or a good use of time, because the kids have, like, a lot of fun, playing them. But sometimes we have to connect with kids by relating to the things that are of high priority to them. So I find myself talking about games a lot, asking kids what is really relevant and important about games, and from there trying to kind of, you know, move on to things that might be, you know, also important for them to talk about, which are less natural. So Setting the tone, again, is the best way for getting into that mental orbit. And too often we try to talk about big topics with boys on the fly without changing the pace or the tone of our conversation. And then we shouldn't be surprised when they just, kind of shrug us off.
Speaking of pace, I found it really interesting in the book, and you mentioned that other people are surprised at this too when they see often your intake interview with the boys. You kind of machine gun fire the questions at them really fast.
I do. I absolutely do. And that's kind of part of using the task stone is that, the kind of expectation is that in therapy we're going to have this very gentle and slow way of interacting. And in some cases, that may be appropriate. I mean, certainly every therapist has kids who come in who are highly anxious or very fearful or have had something very difficult happen in their lives, and we have a way of approaching that. But very often for the kids that I'm working with who are just socially disconnected and who really feel resistant about therapy, I begin asking questions, and I always ask questions that are very easy to answer, and often those questions are about food. Because food is very high priority for boys. It's one of the most important issues in their life, and it's one of the things that they have a lot of opinions about. So I'll just begin asking about the food at their school or what they had for lunch today, and I might move on to, other activities that they do extracurricular-wise or television shows that they watch or characters in their favorite cartoons or television shows. Things that they can easily answer and about which they have an opinion, because the important thing is in the context of my office or in the living room of people who are listening to this show, the important thing is that the boy's voice is being heard and that he gets used to hearing his voice and that his answers and comments are helping to lead the conversation.
Do the boys sometimes look a little shocked, like, wow, how do you get that much out of me in such a short amount of time?
Never. They really love it. When you ask those questions, rapid fire like that, it's as natural as could be. It's almost like they anticipate that this is the way that life should work. And the person that looks shocked is mom and dad.
Huh.
They're the one that really looks shocked because they're like, how is this happening? How is this happening? Because we never have conversations like this. We ask. And I'm trying to demonstrate in a way that it's because we're trying to ask these really big, complex questions before we first kind of get some back and forth going.
Now, you do challenge the idea that joking and horsing around are a way to get in. This is not an approach you take, apparently?
About joking and horsing around?
I mean, to get into the confidence of a boy.
Well, I believe that joking and horsing around have a role for sure. I mean, I think that a lot of kids really respond to joking, that it's disarming and it feels comfortable. I think often we only joke with people that we like, and particularly when we're talking about like middle school age boys, one of the big issues in their life is, will I be liked? They're all constantly worried about whether or not they're going to be liked. So I think it's very important to convey that we are interested in someone. But, we have to be careful because, as the joking can sometimes feel like, sarcasm or criticism or something that, just causes the child to have the opposite reaction than what we want. They kind of close down.
Adam Cox, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a clinical psychologist practicing in Rhode Island. He's the author of several books, including the latest, Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. I do want to talk about boy-girl differences, because there's some interesting stuff you bring up in here about research on hormones and working memory.
Yeah, well, there was an important study done in Canada about the working memory differences between males and females. And so one of the issues that we see is that, it looks like boys tend to be very self-absorbed. And when we're talking with them, they often kind of come across as, well, I'm completely in my own world and I'm indifferent to your world. But what we kind of realize is that the working memory differences of males and females is somewhat notable, and this is true in childhood in terms of the neuropsychological testing that's done on boys, but also was an interesting study done on adults, and particularly on menopausal women who suddenly experienced a decrease in estrogen and began to exhibit some of the same working memory difficulties that are more commonly found in males. And so this has kind of led to some speculation that working memory is really the critical difference in the way that, males and females respond in communication more than, a trait of self-absorption. And I think these things are, they tend to be very contentious issues, these whether or not there are gender differences. I think most gender scientists would certainly agree that the genders are far more alike than they are different. It's hard to quantify what those differences are. Are they 5%, 2%? I don't know. But I do know that we tend to pay a lot of attention to what the differences are, whatever they are. And so that particular difference, is often a real irritant in communication between genders, and particularly, you know, moms will express their frustration with this when trying to connect with adolescent sons.
You describe positive emotions as magnets for boys, and that's something that can help in the toolbox of trying to communicate with them. How can you make use of positive emotions?
Well, I think that, you know, we sometimes feel like, you know, the only time that we're going to have a conversation when there is a problem. And
the old we need to talk thing?
Yeah, we need to talk, like, you know, and so no wonder boys are always thinking, okay, so what did I do wrong now, right? You know, so I'm like, you'll leave me alone unless I've done something wrong. So I think that we should sometimes just be more openly joyful. And, one of the things that, in talking about positive emotions, I feel like one of the most neglected issues in psychotherapy with boys is love, that love almost never comes up because the therapy is always about a problem. So we don't talk to boys about, you know, different manifestations of love in life and how they deal with these things. We talk about, you know, relationships with parents as ones of respect and obligation and responsibility, but we don't often even probe the very notion of, like, you know, your love for your parents. I mean, do you love your parents? And how is that love manifest? And how do you want it to be reflected in your actions and choices and those kinds of things? And we can't expect boys to act on those emotions if we don't bring some voice to them, you know, in our conversations with them, and certainly in our therapy with them. So I have, you know, been just advocating that we try to focus on not only, important emotions like love or joy, but also on the positive aspects in boys' lives, their attributes, the things that they do well, the things around which they feel a stronger sense of capability, so that we don't have this relentless social conversation about the pathologies of boys, because that's what's been going on for the last 20 years.
So again, the first part of the book is all about setting the table, setting the tone for a conversation. You get the content in section two of the book, and you said you meet a lot of boys, or I guess all of us meet a lot of boys, who just don't know the words to express what they're feeling. So how do you begin to get in there? And I mean, what other kinds of things other than words should we be doing to help encourage communication?
So, you know, here's the thing, Jeff, is that schools do two things exceptionally well. They provide the academics, and they do a lot of work around character education. And I am profoundly grateful to schools for the work that they do in those two critical areas. But there are two other seminal areas of development in the lives of young people which get really ignored. One is their search for authenticity, which is a sense of searching for what is really essential in my life. There are things that I like, that I find fun, but what is really essential to who I am? And secondly is a sense of purpose. That is the critical thing, is that, you know, we talk in our country right now, every newspaper covers stories of the epidemics of anxiety and depression. And yet we rarely understand what is at the root of that. And I think that the missing, you know, link, the thing that is responsible for adolescent depression and that so rarely gets articulated, is existential despair. It's not this concept like we want to attribute it to video games, or we want to attribute it to other, you know, kinds of distraction or worry about the economy and things like that. And some of those worries are for sure real in kids' lives. But existential despair is a major problem for adolescent boys. And that despair comes from not having a sense of purpose, not knowing what their role is in their community, and not feeling a sense of usefulness. Because what we're asking young men to do is essentially sit in their chair, pay attention, get the best grades you can, in an effort for what? I mean, it's not clear to get, you know, an existentially vacuous job at some point in the future. I think they want a sense of purpose. I think they want to know what their life is about, and I think that by the time they are 15 or 16, they want to have a significant role to play, and that is a major change in the way that kind of culture evolves. Kids are physically developing as fast as they always have, but socially, we have now asked them to wait well into their 20s to do something significant and important in their lives.
Adam, are there still societal pressures that factor into this? Because I keep thinking that if you've got problems with not knowing what is essential in your life and you're looking for authenticity, if you're a girl, at least you can talk about it. But it seems like even as far as we've come from perhaps the most macho times in our culture, there's still a certain downward pressure to limit your expressions to things like, well, that sucks, or that's good.
That's right. And in the field of mental health, we have a term for this, which is called alexithymia, which translates from the Greek to mean without words for emotion. And what we know about males is that they have as much emotional complexity as do females, but there is often an obstruction in articulating those feelings. And when those feelings are not formed into words, when they don't come out into the light of day, you can't deal with them objectively. They tend to have some control and dominance over you, and so it's unhealthy. And that's why we see a lot of stress and other kinds of, you know, mental health issues as a result of problems with being effective communicators and with being emotionally expressive. I think that most males have at least some words, like words for anger. Lots of guys have words for anger. But there are more subtle, more complex emotions with which they really, you know, struggle. And so, you know, helping to define that language of emotions and understanding how to express yourself, critical to developing authenticity.
Adam Cox, our guest. The book is Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. We'll come back and talk more with Adam and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to The Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're learning a lot about how to communicate with boys today because Adam Cox, a therapist, a clinical psychologist practicing in Rhode Island, has learned a lot about young people in many years of working with them. He's written another book called Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. And maybe you have some experiences you'd like to share with us or questions you'd like to ask of Adam. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm not going to take the call on the air, but Rika and Grants Pass had some criticism of certainly the use of the term young males instead of boys. Thinks it strips them of their humanity. I know I've been using the term just because I don't want to call them boys when they're getting closer to men, but is there any particular thought you have on that?
Well, I certainly appreciate anybody who is invested in reinforcing the humanity of boys. So, yeah, I don't certainly no offense is meant by that, but I think I tend to use the terms somewhat interchangeably. But absolutely, that is one of the primary reasons that for writing this book is to reinforce the complexity, the humanity, and the psychology of boys. And so it's a pleasure to use that term as well.
Let me look at the obstacles that you list here in trying to get through to boys. When you do approach them, the concerns they're going to have: one, you're invading my privacy; two, you're trying to control me; three, you're boring; four, you're confusing. So back to the privacy one, how do you decide when something is important enough to ask what they are thinking?
Yeah, that's really difficult, and I think that we should give kids some latitude when it comes to those kinds of things, because what we construe as worthy of privacy as adults is not the same as what they're thinking. When you're talking to a 13 or 14-year-old boy who is concerned about privacy, I mean, even small things like a verbal altercation with another student at school may seem to him like a very private matter around which he wants some space and some time before he discloses that. And so I don't think that we press too hard. I think we make it clear that we're available, But, you know, on the other hand, when things are happening that we see are really harmful to kids and that, you know, maybe out of their control, such as, you know, we become aware of some kind of a text exchange that is very hurtful or, you know, is kind of provoking some really undesirable behavior, I think we have to step in and say something. So it's a little hard to know until you know the individual child, but I think the main thing is, and the big evolution for 21st century parents is that we do have to give kids a lot more latitude than we did in the past around privacy.
Yeah, I noticed earlier in the book a reference to that we've pushed boredom to the brink of extinction. You already mentioned the concerns about electronics, but you know, mm-hmm. things are very different for kids now than they were when we were young.
You know, we can have everybody can learn manners, Jeff. It's like, you know, they're matters of just, you know, memorization. We can all learn to say please and thank you and open the door. But if we want to have a civil society, to have a level of civility, we in some way need kids who have the capacity to slow down their thinking and to be able to be reflective. So I have written in the past about the necessity of boredom for a civil culture. And by that, I don't mean that boredom in itself is some type of desirable trait in a person, but the capacity to tolerate boredom signifies the ability to slow down and to be reflective and to eventually develop the capacity to empathize, which is, of course, essential to, you know, acting in a civil way. So electronics have filled up all of the gaps. You know, if we have peaks and valleys in our attention, electronics have filled up all of the troughs, all of the kind of valleys. And so many young people now, they have minds that just kind of work kind of going from one peak to the next peak where they're constantly being stimulated. And then that's why we see the kind of, you know, irritability and high-strung tension. I don't know. I mean, I have to assume that in your community it's the same as we're kind of experiencing here in the East Coast. But years ago in my clinical practice, I would maybe have, you know, one or two kids a year who needed, who had a problem so severe that they needed psychiatric hospitalization. Now it seems like every week I'm confronted with someone who's having that problem, and I am often working with families where fathers and sons are getting into some kind of physical tangle over the use of a smartphone or some other kind of electronic that has just become, you know, this dominant factor in family life. So, no question, it's a major challenge at this time in our history.
Wow, that's not great to hear. Let's take a call here. We have Kit in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Cox, the author of Cracking the Boy Code.
Thank you, Jeff. I wanted to comment on the, I guess, personal identification. I've been involved in the martial arts for 50 years, and when I was a teenager in the 60s, there were a lot of things going on, a lot of protests, and who are we, and do what your parents say, and do what the school says. And for me, and I was not necessarily tremendously athletic, the martial arts provided some real direction, and it was physical and gave an identity. And I've worked with kids ever since in that way, and there have been a lot of kids that it was the last-ditch effort for the family, and they put them into martial arts, and it was a case of this is what you do, this is how you learn, and this is who you are. So I just wanted to, on the one hand, say this is great. Everything I'm hearing just is alignment with what I've been dealing with for years. And my how it personally has been a thread of identification to a degree throughout my life.
All right.
Really enjoying the program.
All right. Thanks for that, Kit. Appreciate that. So do you make any particular specific recommendations, Adam, for, you know, let's get them into sports, get them into martial arts, have them in an art class, something like that?
I'm a big fan of martial arts. I often am referring kids to the martial arts studios that are near my office, which I think are incredibly constructive. They help build kids' confidence. They teach them with focus. They really reinforce accountability to schools and families and so forth. So I think that's great for kids. And, you know, I am a sports fan and I love sports, but I sometimes am frustrated with the fact that almost all of the kinds of, you know, recreational opportunities in a community tend to be sports oriented, and I am you know, always searching for alternatives for kids that might be more arts oriented. So, you know, I am also a big advocate of theater programs, of visual arts programs, of doing photography with kids, because I think that's a neat way for them to kind of develop a sense of authenticity, to develop a sense of their own vision and so forth. So, yeah, absolutely.
Becca in Lane County sent an email. She asks, could part of the problem with adolescent boys be that in all times up to the recent, young men started working at a young age out of necessity? No time to decide who you were or what you wanted. There was no school, no privacy, just hard work. That again from Becca in Lane County.
That is a genius of a point. That is right on point, and absolutely, and I make the point in my book that urgency and necessity are often two of the most powerful factors that propel a sense of purpose. And one of the benefits of middle class, for example, is that we have removed a sense of necessity from life, that you have more time. There isn't this sense of crisis and urgency, perhaps. So, you know, in some ways we might say, well, that's good, and there have been lots of, you know, developments in culture that are positive as a result of that. But one of the things that we've lost is the immediacy of the moment and something that is, you know, so valuable for kids. At one time I was doing a focus group with kids in South Africa and talking about this topic, and, you know, I said to these kids, I said, well, you know, how many of you would be interested in doing some type of altruistic work in your life? And there was this kind of half-hearted raising of hands, and kids said, well, you know, if I could live in San Francisco, I'd like to do something like that. You know, these kinds of, you know, fantasy thoughts. But then, you know, I asked the question in a different way, and I said, well, if the head of your school walked in here right now and said that there was a crisis in downtown Johannesburg and six students from this school were immediately needed to get in a van and to go downtown and to help with that crisis, and you wouldn't be home until after dark, and your clothes might get soiled or torn, and there would be some foul language, and you had to be on time for school 8 o'clock the next morning, how many of you would volunteer? And every hand immediately shot up.
Wow.
And so the message there is that where there is urgency and necessity, where there is a sense of purpose, I think boys are often all in.
Oh, wow. So this comes back, it's a much milder level of it, but, you know, when you talk about the what you got from the Gladiator movie and giving people a sense of purpose, or at least that they're part of something bigger than themselves, you know, you're working on the beginnings of what becomes much larger in the Johannesburg example.
I think that's you use the key phrase, something bigger than themselves.
Let's take another call. Ben in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Cox.
Hi. Yes, I'm a volunteer mentor and a retired school counselor for middle school boys, and I'm really struck this past year by how many of them seem to have no sense of responsibility, even at 10 to 12 years of age. They forget to come to the meetings, they're not prepared for their classes, they haven't done their homework, and I've been trying to instill in the boys how important it is. I was glad to hear you talk about respect and honor. And the third one I would like to suggest is responsibility. Have you any feelings about how that could be instilled in young boys?
All right. Thanks for that, Vince.
Well, I am certainly on the same wavelength. And when I talk about honor, that's really a major component of it. And so, and let me just kind of say, Jeff, that in my office, I always define strength and honor as the strength to do what's right, the honor to do it well. And so, you know, that sense of honor, which is part of responsibility to family, to school, to society, to community, those kinds of things, absolutely important. And the first part of that is, and I think that the caller is probably doing work that's along the same lines as what I'm doing, is we talk about it. We have some open conversation about what is your responsibility? Where does your honor come from? And I don't think that ever comes up. We're always, you know, putting kids into that kind of corner where you're in trouble and what are you going to do to make up for this and, you know, what's the consequence going to be? But when we talk about honor, it's like we're giving kids a promotion. We're kind of, you know, seeing them through a more adult lens and through a lens of greater competence and greater respect. And so I don't think that we can expect kids to give us respect if we aren't also giving them respect. One of the reasons I emphasize this task tone and concepts like honor is because the subtext of those things is absolutely the giving of respect. And sometimes we think, well, they haven't done anything to earn the respect, but it's just like, you know, walking through an orphanage where babies are crying and thinking to ourselves, well, we're not going to reach down and pick up and cuddle a baby until they stop crying. They have to earn our warmth. That's ridiculous. We would never think like that. We would, of course, reach down and cuddle that child until they felt more assured to stop crying. We should do the same thing with boys. Give away the respect in massive doses, and eventually they will learn to give it back to us.
And that's why you mention it here, and it should go without saying, but you say it, the idea that not to judge what you're hearing back, but, I mean, How best for a parent to keep a poker face if the ideas that are coming out of the kid's mouth sound like magical thinking and not much more than that?
It is so hard. It is absolutely one of the hardest things to do, which is to think, okay, so I'm not always in a teaching role. I may be the parent and I know more, but if I use every conversation as an opportunity for correction or challenge or teaching, then I essentially shut down any sense that we're getting to know one another. And there is a point, usually sometime around, you know, age 11 or 12, where I think boys are interested in us just being interested in them, and it's more important that they're expressing themselves, even if they say something that we think is just obviously wrong or misguided, to at least kind of give lots of opportunity and ask questions. We should be, like, you know, asking questions, not in the sense of just always challenging or correcting, but just trying to get to know who they are, because they feel that difference, and they decode our tone more than they decode anything else. The most important signal that we use in communicating with kids is our vocal tone. Nothing is more powerful. Nothing is more significant than that. So they can tell when we really are interested in knowing them and being open with them, and when this is just, you know, some kind of form of judgment.
The respect part then explains one of the directions you give, which is to begin with his expertise. So essentially what you're saying to a boy is, okay, I know you know stuff.
That's right.
And it's important to them that they know stuff.
And we've got to find out what it is. I can't tell you the number of conversations that I began asking about, you know, a boy's favorite sport, or how plumbing works, or, you know, his place of faith, or something about his school or his friends or some other idiosyncratic interest that he knows a lot about. What's important is that he know a lot about the things, you know, or that he say a lot about the things that he knows about. Sometimes when I really want to kind of make a point of this, I ask kids to come and sit in my chair, and I lie on the sofa and let them tell me about a favorite cartoon or something. And it's a little bit funny, but it's also reinforcing the idea that you should do a lot of the talking.
Wow, and they really are in the driver's seat in a sense there for a minute
or
two.
They are.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. All kinds of good stuff in the book. It's called Cracking the Boy Code, How to Understand and Talk with Boys. It is the latest work out of Adam Cox, a clinical psychologist practicing in Rhode Island. Adam, good to have you. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.